Welcome back to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. Why is the fight against ISIS taking so long? Who are our allies and where is the path forward? Confronting ISIS is a two-hour frontline special that premieres tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on PBS, SDPB-TV. It features on-the-ground reporting from Iraq, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Syria, and Turkey, and candid interviews from inside Washington's corridors of power. Correspondent, writer, and producer Martin Smith joins us now via phone to talk about the latest. Martin Smith, welcome back to Dakota Midday.
Thank you, Lori.
Martin Smith, are you there?
Yeah, I'm right here. Okay. Can you hear me?
Yep, yeah,
sorry.
I
said thank you, Lori. Good to be on.
All right. I have about 100 questions I would like to ask you.
Well, let's get started.
We better get started. So let's just start with that first question, which I think is what you were wondering, too. What's taken so long?
Well, it's because it's a lot more complicated than you're led to believe. And I mean, we've had a campaign season in which defeating ISIS is presented as a no-brainer, and that for some reason the Obama administration just hasn't been trying hard enough. The fact is that it's a region, the Middle East, where everything is connected to everything else, and the fight against ISIS is we're doing it without American boots on the ground, or trying to, and we've tried to rely on local forces and local allies, and it's been very hard to get their buy-in to something that, frankly, is not their number one priority, defeating ISIS. ISIS is not something they like, but they have other problems. All these countries have other priorities.
So you start this story in Mosul, with ISIS taking over Mosul. Why begin there for this project?
Well, that's when previously I did a program called The Rise of ISIS that looked at their development and ended with the taking of Mosul. The Rise of ISIS was aired on Frontline in October of 2014 after they took it over in June and moved down towards Baghdad. So this was to pick up where we left off, and the commission by Frontline was to do a program that just took a look at the U.S. offensive against them. So I made a trip to the region and found out that it was going to take a lot more than a one-hour program to get that done. Thus this program. We start in Mosul because that's when they came on our radar. They had been around, and they were previously known as Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And they had even taken other cities before Mosul. But Mosul's the second largest city in Iraq, so that got people's attention.
And at that point, Americans still want a political solution.
Well, the thing was that the president didn't want to get involved in launching a military campaign right away because he saw the government of Nouri al-Maliki in Iraq as the cause, one of the causes. His oppression of Sunnis had led to the rise of the sort of extremist Sunnis of ISIS. And so he wanted first for the Iraqis to get a new prime minister, and therefore he resisted for a full 3 months until Maliki was gone, and the Iraqis had a new prime minister in Haider al-Abadi, before he would act. And that gave ISIS a lot of time, really, to consolidate, to gather recruits from around the world. They were really largely unpunished in that three-month period before September of 2014.
There are some names in this documentary or this Frontline two-hour special that are kind of familiar then, but maybe haven't been thought about for a while. James Foley. Let's talk about this American James Foley. Remind us who he was.
Yeah, James Foley was a journalist, like myself, who had spent time in the Middle East, and he got himself in trouble and was taken captive by ISIS. And ISIS then made a very slickly produced videotape about his beheading, in which the executioner, a guy named Jihadi John, who's now dead, said, "This is James Foley, a citizen of your country," staring into the camera, the United States. So that was a direct attack on America.
And then Chuck Hagel. Immediately after we meet James Foley again, Chuck Hagel comes out, and the tone has changed.
Well, at that point, Chuck Hagel, the Secretary of Defense, says that this is a much greater threat than it had been assessed to be. And the, up until that point, the White House was downplaying or speaking in more measured tones about the threat of ISIS. After the execution and the videotape posted on YouTube of James Foley and all its grisly horror, Hagel says this is a far bigger threat than had been previously thought. And so that rankled the White House some, because he was really going off message with that.
Mm-hmm.
And that set in motion a kind of conflict between the Pentagon, between Hagel and the White House.
Let's talk about the words to degrade and ultimately destroy. Give us the background for that, and tell me why those words are so significant.
Well, anytime the president makes an announcement of policy, in this case, to degrade and ultimately destroy ISIS, you can bet that there's been a lot of meetings and talk about which words to choose. And so we sort of dug there, and we found by talking to people inside the White House that indeed there had been a lot of back and forth about just, you know, degrade, defeat, contain. There had been a lot of words bantered about until they finally came up with this phrase, to degrade first, to sort of knock them back, and then ultimately destroy, ultimately meaning that, you know, we're not going to do it right away, it's going to take some time. So, you know, in that little nugget of those words, degrade and ultimately destroy, in just four words, you had a lot of, there was a lot of rich sort of backstory to that. So we talked to people in the White House about how they arrived at that.
I thought that was a really interesting place to dig. And throughout this front line, there are many times where you're asking questions that are plain stumping or causing people to sort of stammer or think twice. How did you know that that was a good place to start looking? And how do you sort of approach these interviews as a correspondent and get at that core like no one else really seems to do?
Well, these are, if you study the chronology, and that's how we begin these projects, is we start compiling a chronology, a very detailed, well over 100 pages of chronological points and everybody's statements at various times. And once you read that and reread it and reread it, you begin to see where there are obvious sore points, conflicts. It's not surprising that within the administration, I think it's appropriate that when you have a challenge like how do you go after this group, ISIS, there's going to be disagreement, there's going to be discussion. And you read the papers, you read the stories, you make your own chronology of events, you start to talk to people on the phone. Mm-hmm. It's not too long before you start to discover where there have been arguments, conflicts. And you really want to look into those because they help you understand just how we've arrived at decisions and how people on the inside see things and where they see weaknesses themselves and where they are worried that something might not work out. And you want to look there.
What kind of thinking has President Obama brought to the conversation over his time in office? How does he approach these conversations consistently, or has his policy evolved?
I would say that on the score of trying to keep Americans out of another war in the Middle East, he's been quite consistent. And that's where he's come in for a lot of criticism, because the urge to go to war, to put American boots on the ground, there's a lot of pressure on him to do that. But as he says, I was elected to get America out of war, not to get us into wars. So as a result, he defined our objective as narrow. There are wars all over the Middle East. There's one in Yemen. There's a lot of sectarian violence within Iraq. There's Saudi Arabia and Iran are going at each other. Then, of course, the war in Syria, which there's no more horrendous situation anywhere. But the president says, no, I'm not going to get involved in any of that stuff. I'm going to narrowly go after ISIS. Well, it's hard to do without tripping across these other fault lines in the region.
What are some of those?
He has been consistent.
What are some of the fault lines that American policy has tripped over then?
Well, they're both ethnic and they're both sectarian. Well, ethnic, particularly in the fact that when the president made his speech, we're going to degrade and destroy ISIS, about 10 days later, ISIS moved towards this the Turkish border, which they wanted to secure a key border crossing in the town of Kobani. And defending that town were Kurds. And our NATO ally has had a decades-long war with Kurdish separatists.
Turkey, you mean, our NATO ally, Turkey.
Yeah.
Yes.
What did I say? Yes.
Just confirming for, you said but
Our NATO ally, Turkey, has had a long-running battle with these separatist Kurds. And so they wanted nothing to do with helping these Kurds in Kobani fight ISIS. And the United States is like saying, no, you've got to help us. You've got to help these Kurds. You're right on the border. And the Turks refused. So right away, our NATO ally, a coalition, anti-ISIS coalition partner, at least on paper, was refusing to cooperate and refusing to allow us to fly planes from their air bases. And so we were tripping across a major ethnic fault line within days of announcing that we're going to degrade and destroy ISIS.
People inside the White House are saying the situation in Syria is the most complicated issue that anyone in government has ever faced.
Well, you know, that's quite a claim. You'd have to go back through, I think
right.
The Civil War presented some problems. But yeah, I mean, the problem here is that, you know, you can imagine a strategy in Iraq where you rebuild the armed forces of Iraq and then you go after ISIS strongholds within Iraq. But you have no sort of partner in Syria. The regime of President Bashar al-Assad is not going to be on your side, or they're not somebody you want to cooperate with. So how do you go into Syria? Well, we tried we had the Kurdish forces in northern Syria, which caused trouble, as I've explained, and as you see in the documentary quite vividly. But we tried to train up some Syrian Arab forces, and it was just a complete fiasco. The U.S. spent $500 million on training a force, and at the end of the day, they had four or five fighters.
President Obama will not be our president for much longer, and one of the current presidential candidates will take the reins of this policy. What are the options for America going forward that make any sense at all?
Well, first of all, I think they have to stop talking in sound bites about a situation that doesn't easily lend itself to being understood in a few sound bites, like bombing them back to oblivion or simply instituting a no-fly zone. It is a very complicated policy and to figure out. And I think they've got to separate Iraq from Syria as two different theaters, and there has to be a tremendous amount of diplomatic work to be done. I think that the real problem is, and you get this from everybody in the region, is you have to decide what you're going to do about Bashar al-Assad in Syria, the regime. Because until that regime settles, is deposed or comes to the table, and there is a real peace, ISIS can take advantage of the chaos in that country, and they will be protected. We have no easy way of going after ISIS inside Syria. Mrs. Clinton says that we need a no-fly zone, but the Russians are in that, are flying their bombers over Syria. And so how are we going to, confront the Russians? Well, perhaps, but that's a momentous decision.
Mm-hmm.
And then Mr. Trump, he doesn't tell us what he's going to do, but he says whatever it is, it's going to be easy. And I don't think, I defy anybody to watch this documentary tonight and say it's easy.
And I encourage everyone to watch this documentary. Confronting ISIS is a two-hour Frontline special. It premieres tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on PBS and SDPB-TV. Martin Smith, thank you so much for joining us again. Please come back and continue your good work.
Oh, thank you very much, Laurie.